The sound of their cries was so shrill, so inhuman, that it even startled Zuga, while the effect on the victims was miraculous. They let fall the burdens they carried and dropped to earth in a paralysis of superstitious awe, adding their wails and screams to the pandemonium. Then the thud and clatter of cudgels against skull and cringing flesh mingled with it all, and the screams and howls rose to a new pitch. Yanshurut's men had spent much time and care on selecting and cutting their clubs, and now they wielded them with lusty glee, making up for a night of discomfort and boredom. Sergeant Shurut himself was in the thick of it, and in his excitement he had almost lost his voice. He was yipping squeakily like a demented fox terrier with a cat up a tree. Zuga knew he'd have to stop it soon before they killed or seriously maimed somebody. But the punishment was richly earned, and he gave it a minute more. He even joined in himself when one of the prostrate figures scrambled to its feet and tried to dart away into the undergrowth. Zuga swung his staff and brought him down again with a blow to the back of his knees. And when he sprang up again, as though he were on springs, Zuga dropped him in the dust with a short right-handed punch to the side of the head. Then, stepping back out of the fray, Zuga took one of his few remaining cheroots from his top pocket and lit it from the chimney of the lantern, inhaling with deep satisfaction, while around him the enthusiasm of his Hottentots flagged a little as they tired, and Yanshurut regained his voice and became coherent for the first time. "Slaughter the kerls! Hit them, boys!" It was time to stop it, Zuga decided, and opened the shutter of the lantern. "That's enough, Sergeant," he ordered, and the thuds of blows became intermittent, and then ceased, while the Hottentots rested on the cudgels, panting and streaming with the honest sweat of their exertions. The deserting porters lay moaning and whimpering in pitiful heaps, with their loot scattered about them. Some of the packs had burst open, and trade cloth and beads, flasks of gunpowder, knives, mirrors, and glass jewellery were strewn about and trodden into the dirt. Zuga's fury returned at full strength when he recognized the tin box which contained his dress uniform and hat. He delivered a last kick at the nearest figure and then growled at Sergeant Shurut. "Get them on their feet and clean it up." The nine deserters were marched into camp, roped together, and bearing not only the heavy burdens which they had stolen, but also the impressive set of contusions, cuts, and bruises. Lips were swollen and split, some teeth were missing, and a good many eyes were puffed closed, and most of their heads were as lumpy as newly picked Jerusalem artichokes. More painful than their injuries, however, was the ridicule of the entire camp, which turned out to a man to jeer and mock them with laughter. Zuga lined up the captives, with their booty piled in front of them, and in the presence of their peers made a speech in limping but expressive Swahili, in which he likened them to sneaking jackals and lurking hyena, and fined them each a month's wages. The audience was delighted with the show, and hooted at every insult, while the culprits tried physically to shrink themselves into insignificance. There was not one of the watching porters who would not have done the same thing. In fact, had the escape succeeded, most of them would have followed the next night. But now that it had been foiled, they could enjoy the vicarious pleasure of having escaped punishment, and the discomfort of their companions who had committed the sin of being caught. During the noon rest that divided the two stages of the next day's Tirukesi, the clusters of porters chatting in the shade of the Mapani groves agreed that they had found a strong master to follow, one whom it would not be easy to cheat, and it gave them all confidence for the future of the safari. Coming directly after his defeat of the Portuguese, the recapturing of the deserting porters added immeasurably to Zuga's standing. The four indunas of the divisions agreed that it was fitting that such a man have a praise name. They conferred at length, and after considering many suggestions, finally decided on Bakela. Bakela means the one who strikes with the fist, for this was still one of Zuga's many accomplishments which impressed them the most. Where Bakela led, they were now prepared to follow, and though Zuga spread a dragnet of his faithful Hottentots behind the column each of the following nights, no more fish swam into it.
"How many?"
Zuga whispered, and Jan Chirrut rocked on his heels, sucking softly on the empty clay pipe and squinting his oriental eyes thoughtfully before he shrugged.
"Too many to count. 200, 300, perhaps even 4. The ground had been ploughed up into soft, fluffy dust by the multitude of huge cloven hooves, and the dark pats of dung were round and shaped in little concentric circles completely indistinguishable from those of domestic cattle, and the rank smell of cattle was heavy on the heated air of the Zambezi Valley. For an hour they had followed a small herd through the open Mupani forest, stooping under the low branches with the thick, shiny double leaves, each of them shaped like the cloven spore that they had followed. And now, where the spore emerged from the forest, it had been joined by another, much larger herd. "How close?" Zuga asked again,
and Jan Chirrut slapped his own neck, where one of the buffalo flies had settled. It was the size of a honeybee, but dull black, and the long needle of its proboscis stung, as though it was white hot.
"We are so close that the flies that follow the herd still linger,"
and he pushed his forefinger into the nearest pat of wet dung. "And the
body heat is still in the dung, but,"
Jan Chirrut went on as he wiped his finger on a handful of dry grass, "but they have gone into bad ground," and he pointed ahead with his chin. A week before they had reached the escarpment of the valley, but each of the possible passes that Zuga had examined through the telescope had proved on closer inspection to be dead ends, the gorges pinching out into abrupt rock faces or falling off into some terrifying abyss. They had turned westwards, following the edge of the escarpment, Zuga ranging ahead with his small scouting party. Yet day after day those impassable heights loomed at their left hand, rising sheer into the unknown. Even below the main escarpment, the ground was tortured and riven by deep gorges and ravines, by cliffs of dark rock and hills of enormous tumbled boulders. The ravines were choked with the drab grey stands of thorn, so densely interwoven that a man would have to crawl in on his hands and knees, and his vision would be limited to a few feet ahead. Yet the herd of many hundreds of buffalo that they were following had disappeared into one of these narrow gorges, their thick hides impervious to the cruel red-tipped thorn. Zuga took the telescope from his haversack, carried by his bearer, and carefully scanned the ground ahead. It had a wild and menacing beauty, and for the hundredth time in the last few days he wondered if there was a way through this maze to the empire of Monomotapa.
"Did you hear that?" Zuga demanded, lowering the glass suddenly.
It had sounded like the distant lowing of the milk herd as it returned to the farmyard.
"Ja!"
Sergeant Chirrut nodded, as again the mournful sound echoed against the black ironstone cliffs and was answered by the bleat of a calf.
"They are lying up in the jesse bush. They won't move again till sunset."
Zuga glanced up at the sun. It was 4 hours or so from its zenith. He had over 100 mouths to feed, and they had rationed out the last of the dried fish 2 days before.
"We'll have to go in after them," he said,
and Jan Chirrut removed the stem of the pipe from between yellow teeth and spat reflectively in the dust.
"I am a very happy man," he said. "Why would I want to die now?"
Zuga lifted the glass again, and while he scanned the ridges of higher ground about the choked valley, he imagined what it would be like in there. When the first shot was fired, the jesse bush would be filled with huge, ferociously charging black animals. The fluky breeze coming down the steep, narrow valley brought with it another powerful whiff of the herd smell before it faded. "The wind is down the valley," he said.
"They have not smelt us,"
Chirrut agreed. But that was not what Zuga had meant. Again he examined the nearest ridge of high ground. A man could work his way along the edge of it, up towards the head of the narrow valley. "Sergeant, we're going to flush them out," he smiled,
"like spring pheasant."
Zuga had found the native names of his personal bearers hard to pronounce,
and tiresome to remember. There were four of them. He had selected them with care, rejecting half a dozen others in the process, and he had rechristened them Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They had earned enormous prestige by being so honoured, and had proved keen and willing to learn their duties. In a few days they were already proficient at reloading, though not yet at the same standard as Camacho Pereira's gun-bearers. But that would come. Zuga carried the Sharps rifle, but each of the four bearers had one of the heavy four-to-the-pound elephant guns that Harkness had recommended to Zuga. At any time he had only to reach back over his shoulder, and a loaded and primed weapon would be thrust into his hand. Apart from the elephant guns, his bearers carried his blanket roll, water bottle, canvas food bag, spare ball and powder, and the little clay fire pot from which a smouldering ball of moss and wood pulp could be blown into flame in a few seconds. It was wise to conserve the amenities of civilization, such as swan vestas, for the months and years ahead. Zuga relieved Luke, the quickest and most wiry of the four, of all his equipment except the fire pot, pointed out the path along the cliff, and explained carefully to him what he was to do. All of them listened with approval. Even Sergeant Chirrut nodded sagely at the end.
"My old mother tells me before she throws me out. Jan, she says, remember it's brains what counts."
In the mouth of the valley, where it debouched out into the Mopani forest, was a low outcrop of rock. The black ironstone boulders had been split into strange shapes by sun and erosion, and they formed a natural redoubt, with chest-high walls behind which a man could crouch. 100 paces directly ahead, the dense palisade of iron-grey thorn blocked the valley. But the ground between was fairly open, with a few stunted second-growth Mopani bushes and clumps of coarse dried razor grass as high as a man's shoulder. Zuga moved his party into the lee of the rocks, and himself scrambled onto the highest point to follow through his glass the progress of the almost naked bearer as he picked his way cautiously along the rim of the cliff. Within half an hour he had worked so far up the escarpment that he had disappeared from Zuga's view. It was another hour before, from the head of the valley, a thin tendril of pure white smoke rose gently into the heated air, and then bent into the elegant shape of an ostrich plume before the gentle breath of the breeze. With miraculous suddenness, the rising column of white smoke was surrounded by another living cloud, hundreds of tiny black specks that weaved and darted about and around it. The faint but excited bird cries carried down to where Zuga waited, and through the glass he could make out the rainbow turquoise and sapphire plumage of the blue jay as they rolled and dived for the insects, put to flight by the flames. Competing with them for the feast were the iridescent black drongas, with their long forked tails catching the sunlight with metallic glitter as they swirled above the spreading smoke clouds. Luke was doing his job well. Zuga grunted with satisfaction as new columns of smoke rose at intervals, sealing off the valley from side to side as they spread to meet each other. Now there was a solid wall of smoke from one cliff to the other, and as the smoke turned dirty black, billowing upwards, spinning upon itself, carrying flaming fragments of leaves and twigs within it, it began to roll ponderously down the valley. It reminded Zuga of a snow avalanche he had watched in the high Himalayas, the slow, majestic progress gathering weight and momentum, building up its own windstorm as it sucked the valley of air. He could see the tops of the flames now, leaping above the thorn, and hear the sound of them, like the whispering waters of a distant river. The alarm bellow of a bull buffalo rang like the blast of a war trumpet from the ironstone cliffs, and the whisper of flames rose swiftly to a dull, crackling roar.